Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Face Us with Robin and Lulu. You're listening to the Blog Talk Radio show, Face Us with Robin and Lulu, on the Hidden Truth Revealed channel. The inside scoop today, April 11, 2018, is going to be very interesting. We're going to be welcoming Michael Volpe, and I'm Robin.
I am Lulu.
And you're listening to Face Us,
right,
Robin and Lulu.
And also we'll be joining us will be Retta Daniel. Now, what happened was is the Michael Volpe, a freelance investigative journalist since 2009, recognized as exposing judicial abuse and corruption in divorce and guardianship. Michael Volpe recently finished this article, The Virginia Bar Misuse of Power to Silence Retta M. Daniel. So we are very fortunate to have her come on to our radio show. So Retta has, she's practiced law in Virginia for almost 40 years and a feud lasting nearly four decades between a Virginia lawyer and the Virginia State Bar, VSB, is coming to a head. So we want you to listen here live, and the story is going to be coming to you live like we just said.
Yes, and if you find this conversation to be something that you're interested in and you'd like to ask a question or have a comment, the number that you would use to do that is 1-845-241-9962. And if you push a 1, once you're online, with that'll bring you up to the show. Once you're on the show, if you push a 1, that will let us know that you have a question or a comment, and we'll know that you'd like to get into the conversation. any other announcements?
Let's see. We just have a very small announcement. There was a Colorado Opens Record Act bar. It was a the Colorado Records Act. Polly Lawrence has been trying to pass to get the judicial system back in with the up to par to where they could be under the core Colorado Opens Record Act. Well, that bill passed, but only for sexual assault with the judicial system. It doesn't mean the judicial system is open with the Colorado Opens Record Act. So this bill has been going on for 4 years in very teensy-weensy progress. I feel that it's going to be a long time before Colorado gets on the ball and does something about their court system. It's just not the best system.
It's progress. And we'll take incremental progress, but like to see bigger increments.
Right. And so what we're going to do is we're going to bring Marcy on. She's another host we have on once in a while, and then we'll bring Michael on. He'll be coming on here real quick. I'm very excited to have him on our show. Are you with us, Marcy?
Yes. Hi. Good evening from Florida. I'm excited about the
Marcy
show tonight.
Right. Marcy's
yes.
from Florida, and she comes on with us every now and then. Her mother was forced into a guardianship, and I know that Michael has done some stories on guardianship, and he also does some in court. So we're going to actually bring Michael on, and then we're going to bring Retta on, and we just have to be kind of careful that we don't talk over each other on the radio channel. Sometimes it gets a little frustrating, but just bear with us, everybody. Michael, are you with us?
Yes, I am. And the story we're going to tell today is actually probably a lot more complicated than we can get into. But Retta has several, what I guess you would call controversial cases. But I think we want to focus on one, and that the reason we want to focus on this show on that one is because that is a guardianship case. But this case, this whole story has a whole deal of history. So Retta, as you guys said, has been an attorney for approximately 40 years. She also spent about 8 years actually working for the bar. And I think she's on the air. So what I was hoping to do is she worked for the bar from 1982 to 1990. Is before we get into the present, just hoping she could explain exactly what happened in the 8 years she worked for the bar and why she was ultimately terminated. So can we bring her on so she can tell that part of the story to begin?
Right, and as soon as she calls back in, we'll go ahead and put her on with us. Right now, I think that she might have faded off for a little bit, but
she was on. It looks like it somehow got dropped, but I'm sure she'll call back.
Right. So, but you did an article on this. How long did the article take you to write? Was it a lengthy article or?
Right. It took me a while to write, but let's just get into what happened. Essentially, she worked as what you'd call a prosecutor for the Virginia Bar, prosecuting essentially bad lawyers or lawyers who had done things that were against the rules of the bar. Now, if as a lawyer you break the rules of the bar, the punishment can be anything up to it, including taking your bar card. And in the United States of America, you can't practice legally without your bar card. So if you lose your bar card, you can't be a lawyer anymore. So she would, if a lawyer violated an ethical code, she would investigate it and potentially prosecute them. And what she found out in the 8 years she worked for them is they didn't like prosecutors who aggressively prosecuted certain lawyers. In fact, she recently did an analysis, and the only lawyers who get sanctioned by losing their bar card in Virginia are sole practitioners, minorities, females, and other lawyers who aren't from any big firm. If you're in a major firm in Virginia, there are no lawyers who are sanctioned to the point where their bar card is removed. So that analysis is basically proof that the bar targets the lawyers who are not connected. And So she had a very high-profile case, and she was actually – the woman she was prosecuting was a Vietnamese woman, but she was trying to get some documents from her two lawyers who were very well-connected. And the documents she was trying to find, she thought that, the lawyer's company's, stamp was forged on some sort of a document, and she believed the lawyers had this document. She asked her boss for a subpoena. Her boss gets the subpoena, and within 48 hours, it's not that the lawyers are in trouble. She's in trouble. She gets terminated. This whole case gets sealed, but several years later, this woman who she was investigating wound up going to jail. So, in fact, what she thought this woman had done, in fact, she did do it. But she got fired from the bar, and that basically sets the stage for where we're at now. And that's, when you say there's a feud, that's basically what I meant. It's probably sort of using words. I don't know if feud is the right word. But
right.
That's basically where the friction starts. But essentially, she's been a critic of the Virginia Bar. And this is something that I think you guys probably have talked about from time to time, how the bar fits into a lot of the corruption. But most shows really don't talk about what the bar does or how they influence other things. And that's unfortunate because most bars are very, very corrupt. And the dynamic is quite similar to what it is in Virginia. This is not an unusual thing. So, unfortunately, the bars often protect the connected lawyers. They attack whistleblowing lawyers. We did a while ago the story of Sandra Grazini-Rucki in Minnesota, and her lawyer was actually the bar went after her lawyer. There's a part in her case where her lawyer was forced to conduct part of a custody trial in handcuffs, and according to the bar, it was her fault that happened. The Minnesota bar, that is. So you can find, what Greta found is not unusual. It's not an anomaly, and it's not unique to Virginia. The Virginia bar is not the only corrupt bar. So she continued to practice, and so now we get to the present. So basically, here's someone who has seen the corruption in the bar from the inside, has been a critic of the bar. She's a very aggressive lawyer. One of the cases she picks up is a woman named Mary Jones, and her father was a former judge. His name is William Wellington Jones, and he set up trusts for all of his children, including Mary. And in 2011, Mary discovered that it looked like, he set up these trusts, and then he hired a guy named E. Greer Ferguson, who's a very well-connected attorney. One of his connections, in fact, is his brother. I don't have the job title, but his brother is a bigwig in the bar. So Ferguson's brother is a guy who is a big deal at the bar, so go figure. So this guy becomes the trustee of this trust, and in 2011, Mary discovers, and her father discovered, it looks like he's embezzling from it. As she investigates, she told me, Ferguson looked at her and said, if you don't stop this, I'm going to put your father in guardianship. And that's exactly what he did in 2014. So he didn't put him in guard. I'm sorry, let me be more exact. He started, in the end of 2014, he started the process of putting him in guardianship. This set off like a mad dash where her father was moved from one assisted living facility to another, and he was drugged up repeatedly. And about 3 or 4 months into the guardianship process, it ended because he died. And then this guy, Igor Ferguson, moved from being the trustee of the trust to the executor. And he basically, over the course of this story, I think has held 2 or even 3 different positions within this trust. He's basically done everything you can. And so Reddit took over at the end of 2016, and after she had done the legwork, she suspected this guy was embezzling. So she does a bunch of subpoenas to get bank records and other things to prove this. And I should mention that there's a judge involved, and his name is John Daffron. And one interesting thing about this guy is he's technically retired, except somehow he has a semi-retired schedule. So he's retired, except he keeps hearing cases. But be that as it may, this guy not only was the judge for the trust, but he was also the judge for the guardianship and basically everything else. And what Daffron did was he refused to honor the subpoenas. And what the other thing he did, which gets like into a legalese, he suspended the request. And the reason he did that is because that's not a final order. And since it's not a final order, the rules say you can't appeal it. So he issued a ruling in such a way that it can't be appealed. And then he's coy about it. In one hearing, he says, well, you are entitled to these. You're just not entitled yet. And would not explain what that means or why she would be sometime in the future but isn't now. And basically kept these documents away from her. And she's trying to help Mary with both hands and feet tied behind her back. And
he's on.
Go ahead.
We have her online now if we want to bring her on.
Oh, yeah. Okay, please. Okay. Freddie, you there?
Let's go ahead and bring up Freda.
Hi,
yes,
welcome.
I'm here.
Welcome to the show. Appreciate you coming
Thanks.
On.
Thank you very much.
Freda, I explained some of the details of the case, but can you give some more detail on the case that you worked when you were working for the VSB in 1990 and how things got set up? And I already mentioned that you were terminated, but just explain the story there when you were working for them.
Okay, I'll be glad to. In 1990, I was working 2 cases. They were both misconduct cases against an attorney named Lynn, L-I-N-H, Solon, S-O-L-A-N-D, who was a Vietnamese lawyer from Northern Virginia, Alexandria, Arlington area. She was involved in immigration fraud, conflicts of interest, other types of fraud, and actually later selling babies from Vietnam that were stolen and giving them up to adoption. But my cases, my 2 disciplinary cases that I was prosecuting and investigating involved conflicts of interest, fraud, immigration, that type of thing.
Uh-huh.
And it was all immigration fraud, okay? It was all tied to immigration fraud and fraud on her other Vietnamese citizens, if you will, of the United States. Well, in the course of that, I was working with a retired FBI agent who had come to the State Bar to work as a State Bar investigator, and we discovered that letters in the cases that we were investigating two cases, had been backdated, and that the letterhead indicated that because it was, it had flaws in it. The flaws did not comport with the later letterhead, or the earlier letterhead, I guess I should say. It didn't comport with the earlier letterhead from that time frame. So these letters that were supposed to be from that time frame had been backdated on this altered letterhead, a reprinted letterhead, and we found the flaws. And they were pretty subtle, but they were there. They were printing flaws. So I subpoenaed originally the letterhead from Mylynn Solon, and she didn't produce it. So then I did a normal procedure, which was to file a motion for a rule to show cause and bring her into Alexandria Circuit Court, state bar process, but into the circuit court, to show cause why she shouldn't be held in contempt for not producing the letterhead. And to jump to the chase, we went to that hearing. I took a deputy attorney general with me because her lawyers, who were very well-connected and large firm-connected lawyers, had filed a motion for sanctions against me and the state bar. So we appear at the hearing on a Wednesday, which was April the 11th of 1990. And at that hearing, I call her, of course, as my first witness. And I'm examining her, and she says she doesn't have the letterhead, the manufactured letterhead, that her lawyers have it. So we took a recess immediately. I had my boss, Michael L. Rigsby, who was bar counsel, issue subpoenas for the letterhead from her two attorneys, Alan Croft and Michael Holm. And he faxed those subpoenas to me in Alexandria because at that time we didn't even have cell phones. I had to go to an office to call him. I told him what had happened. He issued the subpoenas from the bar. He faxed them up to me, and I had deputy sheriffs serve Alan Croft and Michael Holm in the hallway with these two subpoenas. The judge then immediately recessed the case. We came out of the courtroom at the recess, and he just said he had an emergency. He didn't explain why. We come out of the courtroom at the recess, and and the deputy attorney general, William Hauser, and I were standing in the hallway talking about what had just happened to us in the courtroom. We'd never gotten to the sanctions part of the case. So we're sitting there talking, and Michael Holm and Alan Croft come out of the courtroom. They walk straight over to us, and Alan Croft said to me, Retta, there's more than two ways to get rid of this case. And I didn't respond to him. And then they turned, he and Michael Holm turned and walked away. And so after Alan Croft and Michael Holm walked away, Bill Hauser, who was the deputy attorney general, said to me, Retta, what did they mean? I said, I'm going to get fired. And he kind of laughed. He said, Retta, you're not going to get fired. I said, yeah, I'm going to get fired. This is Wednesday at lunchtime. On Friday, 48 hours later, Good Friday, April 13th, 1990, I was fired. I had nothing but superior ratings for 7 3/4 years.
Retta, who fired you? Which person fired you?
Michael Rigsby and the executive director, Thomas
Edmonds.
That's
the same person who issued the subpoena. She's being fired over her.
That's right.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt. Keep going.
Okay. I was senior assistant bar counsel. They didn't have anything higher than that under bar counsel. So my position was the senior because I was right under him, under Mike Rigsby. And he and Thomas Edmonds, who was the executive director, and Michael Rigsby was bar counsel, they called me in at lunchtime on Friday, 48 hours later, and they fired me. The interesting thing is Thomas Edmonds, is now running for the bar council for my district. I got that information today. Now, this is the man that fired me along with my boss. The executive director was Thomas Edmonds, and my boss is Michael Rigsby. And now here we are, how many years later? 28 years later, and Tom Edmonds, who retired as executive director, is going to run for a position on the elected council CIL, which is the governing body of the Virginia State Bar in Virginia. When I saw that today,
okay,
I was like, oh, my God. So those are the
right
people who fired me.
Okay, so now you, I don't know if it was an analysis, but explain, like, when you analyzed who the bar investigates and sanctions, and you found overwhelmingly it's people who aren't connected. Explain what you found there.
Okay, I have an investigator working with me who's retired NCIS fraud investigator, and then he worked at the state bar for approximately 4 years as a state bar investigator. So I didn't know him, but I got in touch with him through LinkedIn, and I said, I got fired like you did. So would you talk to me? And so he called me, and we talked, and I told him what had happened to me, and the same thing had happened to him in 2013, I think, because he wouldn't engage in state bar corruption, so they fired him. All right, so we got together, and I said, look, Jim, let's first look at the disciplinary statistics, because I know they're skewed. Let's see what we can find. Well, we have 27 years of state bar data that shows that no large firm attorney, none, and no well-connected lawyer in Virginia has received any public discipline for 27 years. Now, I can tell you that goes back 36 years because I was there the other 8 years before that. And so we have the Virginia State Bar data. We've looked at every single public disciplinary order. We have categorized them. And Jim did a lot of this work because he's the statistical man. He's the data guy, data cruncher. So he crunches all the data, and he finds out that the people who are subject to public discipline, the lawyers who get public discipline, are minorities, women, solo practitioners, and very small firm members who do not have connections. And we looked at every respondent, every decision. He put together spreadsheets with hyperlinks to all the orders, and then he created a report. And the interesting thing we found on the report, which is really nothing we expected to find, is the state bar covered up for one lawyer, Susan Carol Armstrong, who was a Troutman Sanders partner in 2009, who stole $112,000 from a Canadian citizen, and they went through a pseudo hearing, not a real hearing. And at the end of the hearing, the judges, there were three judges in this case, found that she was not guilty of any misconduct. Well, normally that would go unmentioned in the public data that the bar publishes on its own website. But on the bar's website for 2009, and it's still there, even though they know I know it, it's still there, they published she was not disciplined. Now, she was published, and she's only one in 27 years, because she was a partner at Troutman Sanders, and she stole $112,000 from a third-party lender, and they were covering up for her. I have all the exhibits from the bar and from the circuit court, and I have the transcript of the circuit court pseudo hearing, because no hearing really took place. They sent all the witnesses home, and they just simply covered up for her because she was Troutman Sanders' partner. And she actually stole the money because the guy in Canada is now my client. And it's clear from the documents he demanded the refund of his money immediately the next day because she didn't carry out the contract that was to support this $112,000. So he demanded that she return it to him, and she refused. And then she dispersed it, not just to any other client in the world, she dispersed it to her niece, her own niece, who was her legal assistant, her niece. That's some static. She dispersed the money to her niece, a legal assistant at Troutman Sanders, by committing a fraud.
Retta, you're breaking up. I'm not sure if there's anything that you can do to strengthen your connection, but you're breaking up a bit.
Well, I'll try. Just a minute.
Why doesn't she hang up and call back, and then I'll carry the...
I think it's better now. Wait a minute. It's cleared up. Let me see.
Okay.
I'll call back. Call back.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah, I'll call back.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So,
Michael, thanks for being interesting.
Yes, it's very interesting, Michael. I, you hear this coming out of, you know, of what's going on, and you're just like, whoa, you know, she works, you know, she worked for the bar, and she sees all this stuff inside and out, you know, and it's just, it's unreal to listen to. It really is.
Right, and that really doesn't even, you know, that's all small potatoes compared to what they're doing in the Jones case. In the Jones case, basically what they did was they took a trust from a father to his children, and this guy, Egrier Ferguson, is essentially, he's the beneficiary, even though he's not technically the beneficiary on any of these documents. So basically what has happened is between that's the case that when she gets back on, we want to talk about, because she's got way too many cases that the reason that the bar is going after her now is not strictly the Jones case. It's several different cases where she's taken on clients who are up against powerful lawyers, and the bar basically needs to get her out. And so what the bar did was they filed a complaint, not for an ethical violation, but basically claiming that she's now crazy and no longer competent enough to be an attorney. And
oh,
so they held that hearing on Monday, and I actually flew in. And so I get to the building, and we get to the, like, it's like a makeshift courtroom, let's say. It's not, probably not always a courtroom, but it's like in this big room, and I see about 100 chairs for what would be the gallery. So I got excited. I was like, well, if they got 100 chairs, obviously they're going to have an open hearing. So then I walked out. I think I had to go to the bathroom or something. I come back, and now suddenly the door to this room is closed. And I asked one of the people who I'm there with, I said, what's going on? And with no irony, they said, well, they closed the hearing so they could argue whether or not they're going to open the hearing. So in other words, they argued in private whether or not the whole hearing should be open to the public. And, of course, to no one's surprise, the hearing was not open to the public. She had more than a dozen witnesses, included other lawyers, clients, even her husband came, her psychiatrist, her best friend since the 1970s, on and on and on. This former NCIS investigator who's now working for her as a private investigator, he testified. He said, if anyone here is incompetent, it's the people who are deciding it. And in the end, after all of those witnesses, they told her that she needs to do a psychological evaluation with a psychologist of their choice if she wants to keep her license. And that, of course, is almost always a setup. And usually it's an even bigger setup, because the psychiatrist will say, well, if you want to get your license back, first we're probably going to have to do 6 months of intensive therapy at $200 an hour. So, you know, who knows how far this will go. But basically they're given a choice, either do this psychological evaluation or you can't be a lawyer. And, of course, that violates all of her rights. And it's so clearly a setup. And look, like the three main culprits, I don't remember their names, but I knew they were the three main culprits. They once walked through the hall as we're just talking during a break. And I remember as they walked past me, I said, speaking of corrupt people, and I yelled it. And, you know, it's a total farce. It's a star chamber of what was happening in that hearing room. And the whole thing is a response not only to this Jones case, but basically to a series of cases that she's willing to take on clients who are taking on connected lawyers. You know, what the bar is basically trying to say is, don't mess with the lawyers we like.
Right.
And, you know, the bar is not supposed to be saying anything like that. There are serious questions as to how Mary Jones' father died. He was drugged up as he was being moved through all of these, like, halfway houses and assisted living facilities. None of that has been answered. There are serious questions about whether or not the trust has been misspent by this guy, E. Greer Ferguson, and this judge, John Daffron, won't allow those questions to be answered because he refuses to honor subpoenas. Meanwhile, the bar is putting in another roadblock, and that's basically, this is our actual justice system in playing out. Not the one in theory, not the one they're going to teach you in class. This is what actually happens.
Yeah, is it? You're exactly right. And we also had another attorney that came on our show. Her name was Allison Menard, and she was sanctioned, and they did really a lot of work to get her out. And she actually had to flee. She had to flee Colorado. I mean, it's not good what they're doing to attorneys. It's just not.
Right. Like there are a million examples. The most famous or notorious, if you will, is Richard Fine out of California, who figured out that an entire county of judges were double dipping with their pensions. He took on the entire county. This guy used to work in the Justice Department. If you ever see his resume, you know, it just makes you so jealous because he's so accomplished. They not only put this guy in ISO, put him in jail for 18 months, but then eventually took his law license. And so that's an example of how the bar in California, that's in California that happened. That's an example of how the bar in California basically does the same kind of thing. But, you know, you're absolutely right. There's tons of examples. I've been doing some work on foreclosure fraud, and I found that there's a guy named Bill Butler out of Minnesota, attorneys that are trying to expose this kind of fraud in these foreclosures. They're getting sanctioned by the bar. That's absolutely correct. It is not somebody just fighting the guardianship or this specific case. And as I said, or just in Virginia, you can find examples in nearly every state.
Right.
The bar is part of the problem.
Michael, this Allison Menard that we had on our show, she was an attorney with water rights, and they went after her. I mean, so
well, correct.
And I,
correct.
Was,
correct.
Oh,
if you're what I think.
Right. Right. Well, I got Retta back on the line with us. Retta, are you still with us?
Here. It's interesting. Retta? In Virginia, there are two protected classes. One protected class of lawyers includes the large firm members and the well-connected, politically or financially connected lawyers. The other protected class are the lawyers who work for the Virginia State Bar. And they're two distinct protected classes. None of those lawyers get any public discipline and haven't, in my experience, since 1981. I went to the bar to work in 1982, but the first case I encountered was 1981, and I thought it was just a mistake because I was naive. I was young, okay? I didn't know. I'd only been practicing like maybe 5 years. I just didn't realize that wasn't a mistake. But in 82, it came to me graphically when they told me to cover up two cases that were blatant misconduct cases. Both men had been convicted of criminal charges, and my bar counsel, Michael L. Rigsby, told me to not set them up as bar complaints. Well, I didn't listen to him. I found a way to get him set up anyway, made him really angry, but they both got private reprimands because they were well connected. They were not with large firms, but they were very well connected. And that's when I made a vow to myself in 1982 that when this time came in my life, when I was not dependent on my law practice for income, I would take on the bar as a whole. Now, the interesting thing that's happened is in taking on the bar as a whole in the last 2 years, I have realized, and my investigator Jim Whitener and I realized together, that we're not taking on just the bar. We're taking on the Virginia State Bar, the Virginia Supreme Court, and the Virginia General Assembly. So far, we haven't connected it to the executive branch, but we've connected it to the legislative and judicial branches, and there's a web of corruption that exists in the judicial branch and the
right.
legislative
Retta,
branch.
Can you expand on that? How is the bar connected to the Supreme Court and the legislature?
Okay, the way this works, it's interesting in Virginia. The bar is by statute an agency of the Virginia Supreme Court. The Virginia Supreme Court members have to be appointed by the legislature because we don't elect judges in Virginia. All judges in Virginia are appointed by the General Assembly. The General Assembly passes the statutes for the funding of the state bar, and all judicial funding also has to be approved by the General Assembly by statute. What happened that really opened my eyes and Jim's eyes was in 1995, the legislature had the Joint Legislative Audit and Review Commission conduct an audit and produce a report, which is called the 1995 JLARC, J-L-A-R-C, which is Joint Legislative Audit and Review Commission. That's the acronym, JLARC. It's a JLARC report for 1995 on the Virginia State Bar. In the JLARC report, they point out, the JLARC Commission points out what the bar is doing illegally and how it should, in a financial sense, and how it should change its disciplinary process. The bar has gone in the opposite direction. The legislature in 23 years has not made the bar correct their problems. They've never had another audit. They've refused to do another audit at my request. And when I talked to a legislator recently that I've known since he was probably in first grade, he told me that it would be 2 or 3 years, even if we could get lawyer legislators to support it, it'd probably be 2 or 3 years from now before an audit would be ordered to be performed. So, you know, we've got 23 years already of the legislature letting the bar run wild, the Virginia Supreme Court letting the bar run wild, and the legislature controls all of that because the legislature appoints all the judges. The other thing about Virginia, because there are only like 4 or 5 states left that do this, Virginia has what they now called a unified bar. It used to be called an integrated bar, but that's no longer politically correct. So now they call it a unified bar. What that means is it's a huge trade association. It's spending $24 million a year. The disciplinary department is a little tiny unit of the trade association because the bar is an organization. It's not a state agency. It's a Virginia State Bar organization. It's supposed to be a state agency, but it's an organization because it's a trade organization. And they're spending $10 million more a year than they show in their treasurer's report for every year. The State Bar treasurer's report, let's pretend, shows a $14 million receipts and expenditures, okay? The disbursements of the bar are $24 million. So not only have Jim and I now focused on disciplinary, we focused on financial corruption. And the bar has two illegal funds we know about that the Supreme Court set up in 1976-75, and they've been in existence all this time. In 1995, JLARC told them these were not legal funds. Stop using them. Make it right. Well, one of them, the Client Protection Fund, has a $10 million surplus, and lawyers are still paying a surcharge every year, not for a surcharge, which is a tax. We're paying a tax every year to fund a fund that has $10 million surplus. It's nothing but a slush fund.
Wow. Rather, let's discuss more about the Mary Jones case. So the first thing, I gave some background, but can you explain again how you know for sure that there's bulletproof evidence that this guy Greer Ferguson in 2011 started to embezzle? Explain the evidence, how you found it, and why this is such bulletproof evidence that everyone should believe that indeed he was embezzling.
Okay. On August 11th, 2011, E. Greer Ferguson went into his sister's bank, BB&T, where she was the branch manager, and he removed $28,000 and some change dollars from a joint bank account with Mary Margaret Jones and her father, co-owners, both had right of survivorship. He was not on the signature card, but his sister was the branch manager. Gail Pruden is her name, Gail Ferguson Pruden. And in that branch, he emptied their joint account. He put the money in a new account under his name as attorney in fact and left them with not one penny they could access to pay their daily expenses, buy groceries, gasoline, anything, pay utilities. They had nothing. He took every cent of their money. He never returned any funds to Mary Jones, the daughter. Now, with Judge Jones, the father, Judge William Wellington Jones, was probably in his 80s then. He raised a little hell with Greer Ferguson, okay? So Greer Ferguson put $10,000 back in Judge Jones's name alone, not in Mary's name, just in Judge Jones's name, to pacify Judge Jones. And he did pacify him. But then in December, because Judge Jones and Mary didn't know this, because Greer Ferguson had changed all the addresses on all of Judge Jones's accounts, Greer Ferguson cashed in $12,000 CD. Neither one of them knew it, at BB&T, where his sister was the manager. Then in March of 12, and that's only 7 months later, Greer Ferguson cashed in $344,000 of CDs, some BB&T, some Farmers Bank, and some Wells Fargo. But he cashed them all in at once, $344,000. Mary Jones and Judge Jones, William Wellington Jones, didn't know it. They did not know he had done that. And Judge Jones didn't need money. He was receiving over $6,000 a month from retirement and Social Security and other investment income. He was saving money. He was still managing his own affairs. Mary was helping him, of course, manage his affairs because she was his daughter. But he was competent. He was signing legal documents then for Ferguson, for E. Greer Ferguson. And E. Greer Ferguson took it upon himself to take all that money. When you take $30,000 and $12,000, that's $42,000, and you add $344,000 to that, my God, you are at $400,000 in 7 months. This guy liquidated and took away from them.
And by the way, that's just what you found. That's assuming you found everything. Okay, so let's fast forward a little bit. Let's fast forward a little bit. Just explain the circumstances that lead up to this guardianship case, and then give some details of what happened as the judge wound up in probate court, I guess you call it.
Very interesting. It's not probate court. It's regular circuit court in Virginia, which is our highest trial court. But what happened was Judge Jones, we fast forward to 14. This happened in 11 and 12 and 13. Greer Ferguson was liquidating assets like a madman, okay, and taking their money. We get to 14, and Mary finds her father drugged in assisted living facility. I mean, drug, like opiate drug. And he was not prescribed any opiates. He didn't need any opiates. So she finds him drugged up, and he says, he can tell her enough to get me out of here. So she and her friend, Bill Gardner, take him out at night when no one's really paying a lot of attention. And they take him to Newport News, Virginia, which is about, 30 minutes away. And they hide him in a motel, and they let him sober up. It takes several days for the opiates to get out of his system. And after several days, his mind is clear. He can converse. He can feed himself again. He can help groom himself. He was in a wheelchair, but I mean, he could manage, okay? But he was literate. He was cognitive. He had good faculties. So he said to Mary and Bill, I want to change all my documents. And they said, okay, but we've got to take you to lawyers to do that, because we don't want anyone to say that we've influenced you to do that. And he said, oh, no. You take me to lawyers. I want notaries. I want all of this. And so they did that. They took him, and he, with the lawyers and with the notaries, revoked the trust, fired Ferguson. This is all notarized, did a new will, which put Mary in charge, did a new power of attorney so that she would be in charge. He had prior to that done a new medical directive to make her in charge about 6 months before that. But anyway, after that 6 months, he did these other documents in the beginning of November. So when the firing letter is delivered to Ferguson, he ignores it. It's in his billing records. but he ignores the directive that he and his firm were fired, and he continues with the guardianship with this woman lawyer named Allison Zizzo, Z-I-Z-Z-O. And she and Ferguson are definitely cohorts. They're not in the same firm. But Ferguson continues with Allison because he needs a lawyer to represent him because he's the power of attorney. So Allison represents him, and they go forward with the guardianship, even though in his billing records it shows he discussed this letter with Allison Zizzo. They pay no attention to it, and they get to a hearing in mid-November. The judge, though, Daffron, the one that was mentioned earlier, John Daffron, recognizes that Mary's power of attorney is valid, that was from early November, and that her medical directive from April 15th, 2014 is valid. And so he gives her control over the judge with the power of attorney and the medical directive, but then Daffron also appoints Fred Taylor as guardian ad litem, who's Ferguson's hand-picked guardian ad litem, you know, lawyer.
Right, and I should mention he's actually a lawyer. He's a guardian ad litem on this particular case, but he's actually a lawyer. Go ahead.
Yeah, they're lawyer friends in the same town. They're very close friends. In fact, Fred Taylor's going to take over for Greer Ferguson's brother when his brother decides not to run for Commonwealth attorney anymore. And they're all very close. So Fred Taylor becomes guardian. That's mid-November. Now, mid-December, Fred Taylor has Judge Jones examine for competency. Now, this is, you know, like 6 weeks, 8 weeks after the documents were executed. That means nothing in Virginia. You can be competent for an hour or less and execute a legal document in Virginia, and it's valid. So 6 or 8 weeks later, it's a battle. It doesn't make any difference. You can be Lulu, and it doesn't make any difference what you did in the first part of November. So then that's mid-December. The next thing that happens is, of course, Judge Jones has been put back in assisted living. Mary goes to see him at the middle to end of January to take him to a doctor's appointment. He is drugged again, and he's aspirating food, sitting up in a wheelchair, and the nursing home facility, assisted living, says, well, we could take him back to his room, or you could call an ambulance and have him taken to the hospital. Well, of course, Mary called an ambulance. They took him to the hospital in Newport News, Riverside Regional, I don't know what they call it now. It used to be Riverside Hospital. They take him there, and they have to give him 2 doses at least of Narcan, N-A-R-C-A-N, to bring him out of the opiate overdose. He's an opiate overdose. He's comatose almost. He's curled up in a fetal position when they get him to the ER. Well, he comes out with the Narcan doses. He comes out of the opiate overdose. He can converse with the doctors. He can carry on a normal, cognizant conversation with the doctors. But his heart is damaged. He's 93 years old. The opiates and the Narcan obviously damaged his heart. So they put him in ICU. And then Fred Taylor wants to put a do not resuscitate order on him. So Mary threatens to take Fred Taylor to court. So he withdraws the do not resuscitate order that he had put in place, the guardian. Mary couldn't control that.
Right. Can I just interject? This is just one great example of the power that these proceedings give to third parties. You know, this guy didn't know William Wellington Jones 3 months ago. Now he has the power to put a do not resuscitate order on him. All right, go on. I'm sorry, keep going.
Yeah, and the only person who could have authorized the central line to be put in Judge Jones's carotid artery at 93, which would kill him, was Fred Taylor. Mary couldn't do it. Greer Ferguson couldn't do it, but his hand-picked guardian ad litem could do it. So the hospital put a central line in the carotid artery, and Judge Jones died.
Right. Is that and I'm sure that given what you just described, several people have been held accountable. Probably somebody's in jail for all of this.
Nobody's been held accountable. Nobody has been held accountable. The Newport News police will not investigate, which is where he died.
Well, that's probably because nobody's come to them and brought him this evidence.
No, that's not true. Mary went to him. Mary went to the Newport News police, and Mary has gone to the Suffolk police, where Fred Taylor's office is located. Mary went to the Newport News police because that's where Judge Jones died. She went to the Suffolk police because the money has been stolen in Suffolk, and nobody, including the State Bar, has done anything to stop anything or investigate anything.
Okay, so let's fast forward.
Give me one piece of history. In October of 2016, in mid-October, the bar was notified by a third party, not me, not Mary, a third party, that Eagrear Ferguson appeared to be commingling funds from the Joneses' earlier accounts before Judge Jones died and after he died. And it looked like there was embezzlement going on. And that was reported to the Virginia State Bar in writing by a third party. They sat on that complaint for 3 months. We didn't even know about it. And in January, Mary files a complaint 3 months later. They send them both out at the same time, and we found out about the October complaint. And the bar has done nothing since October of 16 to stop Eagrear Ferguson or his attorneys, several attorneys, from taking all of Mary Margaret Jones's money out of the estate and trust. The estate and trust.
Right.
Is now
I want everyone to understand when he embezzles from a trust, the way he's doing it now, he's stealing from a dead man. Okay.
Right.
William Wellington Jones is dead.
That money he earmarked. Wait a minute, Michael. He stole from the dead man before he died. He's stealing from Mary and her son now that her father's dead.
But it's the dead person's money. It's really disgusting. But let's fast forward again.
Michael, wait. Once the person dies, it's no longer his money.
I got it. The point's not worth arguing. Late 2016, you come on the case, explain what you tried to do and how the judge and others responded and what happened from the time you got on the case to the present.
Okay. In September of 2016, I started to represent Mary Margaret Jones because she'd been to 300 lawyers and nobody would take her case. Someone took it and then returned her money. And she finally got to me and she told me the story. And I said, well, Mary, I didn't know her. I said, Mary, I went to law school with Eagrear Ferguson. That was 40 years ago. I haven't seen him for 40 years. It sounds like he's stealing from you. I will take the case. And I will not charge you to do this case. I'll do it for free. So I took the case. And the first thing I did was issue subpoenas, which I know from working at the bar and defending lawyers for 26 years. The first thing you have to do is get the financial records. So I subpoenaed all the law firm trust account records and all the bank records that would be corresponding, all the subsidiary ledgers and all the general ledgers for every trust account that Ferguson, Rawls, and Raines has, which is the law firm. So I'm getting the banks. I'm going after the law firm accounts. I want their operating account, too, and those corresponding bank records. And I want Ferguson's personal records because some of the checks he had cashed. And Jim Whitener's working with me, and he's an expert in this, too, on the investigative side. So we craft the subpoenas. We serve them. Jim serves them. I do them. Jim serves them. And Greg Ferguson hires the partner of a former State Bar president to come in and file a motion to quash. Now, that a motion to quash is a normal procedure. Nothing wrong with that. But the judge
right, motion to quash basically means that instead of the subpoena being honored, it stops it. Go ahead.
It stops it completely if it's granted.
Right.
But the judge didn't
right.
grant the motion to quash, and he didn't honor the subpoenas. He suspended them, which meant I could
now,
not
what appeal. What does that do to a potential appeal, and why?
I could not appeal it because it's not a final order. You have to have a final order to appeal it. That's not a final order because it's a suspension of the subpoenas. If he had quashed them, I could have filed an appeal. But because he suspended them so they could be enforced later, supposedly,
mm-hmm.
I couldn't appeal it. So I couldn't appeal
right, but,
that.
But this all happened in 2016, so I'm sure he's honored the subpoena since then until now.
No.
I'm sure it's no.
No, no. no. He told me in October.
I'm sure he's probably given you a date, though, when they're going to be honored.
Oh. He told me in October 17, a year later, that we were entitled to the records. And this is on the record. This is on the transcript. He told me we're entitled to the records, but not right now. Now, this is a year later.
Wait. When he said not right now, he probably said but at a given date. What was that date that he gave you?
Nope, he didn't give us any date. He refused to give us a date. And now every single investment that Ferguson could get his hands on has been liquidated, and every cent is gone. And it was gone by the end of December of 17. So two months after I was in the courtroom, all the money's gone, all the investments are gone. The only thing left is Mary's real estate, the house she lives in, and 23 acres. So it's about 25 acres total. A prime residential development land, and they're dying to sell it so they can rip her off of another $2 to $4 million, and they haven't been able to do it yet because I'm in the case, and they can't get to the real estate. So now they want me out of the case so they can get to her real estate, sell her real estate, and go through that money. And she and her child won't have anything. They won't have anything.
Right. All right, so now let's get to the conclusion of the story. They're using the Virginia State Bar to go after you. So tell how and why they're using the Virginia State Bar.
Well, that's very interesting because the Virginia State Bar will not go after this crook who's taking all this money, but the Virginia State Bar, based on the judge's complaint from that place, Mary's case, and another judge where that other judge has bankrupted another client of mine. Those two judges are the primary movers and shakers between the bar trying to say I'm impaired and I'm not fit to practice law and I don't know what I'm doing and I don't have good recall.
Let me just cut you off. Hey, Luann and the rest of you guys, you've been listening to her for the last hour. Does she sound impaired?
Oh my God.
No. I'm gonna say if you were on the bar, we'd have no problems. All right, keep going, Retta.
They don't want me to ever be a judge because I would be too honest. You have to be on the take to be a judge, okay? Or
right.
on the board,
you do.
Or something
you,
like that.
By the way, I've heard thousands of stories, and I could not agree more. But okay, so keep going. So what did the bar do? What did the bar do?
So instead of filing a misconduct case against me, because in Virginia, all misconduct hearings are public, and they cannot keep you from having a public hearing, plus you can opt to have a circuit court hearing instead of a disciplinary board hearing. And they know I'll do that because they know I know their rules better than they do. So, and I told them, I said, you file any misconduct cases against me, and I'm going for a 3-judge circuit court panel. No board's going to hear my cases. So they haven't done that. They've got them, but they haven't filed them. And all the misconduct cases, by the way, come from these same judges and these same lawyers who are on the opposing side to my clients. None of my clients have ever complained against me. 41 years almost, I have no client complaints and no disciplinary record. So what they decided to do was use the one secret proceeding, closed door star chamber proceeding that the bar still has, and that is an impairment proceeding. In an impairment proceeding, you cannot get a public hearing. Even if you waive confidentiality, they will not honor it. You don't get exculpatory evidence. They deny it. You cannot have anyone in the courtroom to see what they're doing. They denied me my own court reporter, who's certified, by the way, of course. They denied me my certified videographer who works for that court reporting firm. They would not let them stay in the courtroom, and they used the court reporter that the bar has used for, like, I don't know, 30 years to do their court reporting, and she won't give me a transcript. I ordered the transcript while the hearing was going on a rush, and I don't have it yet.
Right, and I know you ordered them rushed because I heard you actually say it. But listen, I know you didn't have the right court reporter. You didn't have all those other things, but you probably got the right lawyer, so everything worked out.
I have a horrible lawyer. He did nothing.
You've been practicing for almost 40 years. You know all the lawyers in Virginia. You couldn't find a good lawyer?
I could not find a single lawyer who would represent me because they're petrified of retaliation by the Virginia State Bar. So I had to go to my insurance company because I have disciplinary defense coverage. I went to my insurance company, which is in Chicago, CNA, they hired.
Right, that's a very, very big insurance company, especially in Chicago. Keep going.
And they hired a set of lawyers in D.C. who'd never done an impairment case ever, and they're licensed in Virginia, which I told them not to do that, and they got me Virginia lawyers anyway. And these were baby lawyers who knew nothing about anything, and they wanted me to draft all the documents for them. I can't represent myself.
Wait. I want everyone to understand. The bar is claiming you're impaired. Your lawyers want you to draft the documents they are supposed to do. If you're so impaired, how exactly are you supposed to be drafting these documents? Okay, keep going.
I had to draft them because those lawyers didn't know how to draft them. They'd never
done an impairment. Right, but if you're impaired, why are you expected to draft the documents? You're impaired. How are you drafting documents? But anyway, keep going.
Yeah, I should have been only the client, but the lawyers didn't know how to represent me as the client, and because I've got, 36 years of experience, they asked me to draft the documents for them to file with the bar to defend me. And I did one set. I did the motion to dismiss. And then after that, they wanted me to do the next document. I said, no, I'm not going to do it. I'm your client. And I fired them. So I called up the insurance company, and I said, get me new lawyers. Well, damn it, they got me new lawyers in Virginia. It's a well-known law firm. They gave me another lawyer who's never done an impairment case in his career, not even for someone who's impaired, but certainly not any impairment case. And he didn't know how to do it. And I had to send him a of the procedure so he would know procedurally what you can and cannot do in an impairment case and how there's no appeal from an impairment case. There's no exculpatory evidence that they will give you. You don't.
Wait, Rutter, before you go on, explain what exculpatory evidence means. What?
If they have evidence, and they've got to have a ton of evidence that shows that I'm not impaired, they must give it to me. Only in a misconduct case. The bar wrote me, the prosecutor, this is funny. The prosecutor is my prosecutor, and the prosecutor is the same prosecutor for one of my clients. And both cases are right now before the State Bar Board, okay? We're both before the board. In one case, I'm defending a lawyer. In the other case, I'm the respondent, and I'm impaired. The bar is not saying I'm impaired where I'm defending my respondent. They say I'm impaired where I am the respondent. These are active going on hearings right
did
now.
Did you know it? I hope you guys picked up on that because, if you ever read any Orwell, I mean, that's straight out of Orwell. Well, when you're here, you're not impaired, but now that you're here, well, you are impaired. You know, it's
exactly.
Yeah. Or Orwell's in his grave going, why didn't I think of that? That's pretty good. I could have done a lot with that. All right,
it's
keep going. And look, this is the I had mentioned earlier when she called it a star chamber. That's I witnessed that firsthand. As I said, I walked into the building. I get to this room. It's like a makeshift courthouse. I see approximately 100 chairs within what I see as a gallery, and I got excited. I was like, you know, why would they put 100 chairs and not allow the people to come in for the hearing? And the next thing I know, the doors are closed. I ask around, and I find out they're having a closed-door hearing to decide if the hearing should be open.
That's correct.
When I say it's a star chamber, I'm telling you, I witnessed that firsthand. So keep going. You've got to keep going with what happened.
So anyway, one day, before the same board, okay, defending my client on various motions, pre-trial, pre-hearing motions, for a disciplinary board misconduct case. The next day, I'm before the same board as a respondent, and that board is trying to determine, based on the same prosecutor now, the very same prosecutor, Elizabeth K. Schoenfeld, she's trying to say that I'm impaired and they need to order me to sign medical releases, giving up all my HIPAA rights, all my privacy rights, every due process right you can think of, so they can get 5 years of my medical records, which what does that have to do with today? And
right.
I think
not everyone is gonna make the link, but want everyone to understand they're suggesting she's impaired even though they've not seen one medical record. They've not had a medical professional examine her and say she's impaired. You basically have a bunch of lawyers, probably some of them divorce lawyers on top of it, who are deciding that they think she's impaired, and now they want proof that she's impaired by asking for her private medical records. How about that?
That's right. That is exactly right. They have no medical evidence whatsoever, physical, medical, or mental, to show that I have any impairment. They have 6 reports from my physicians saying I'm not impaired. So they want to get 5 years of my medical records and go on a fishing expedition to see if they can find anything in the last 5 years that might indicate that I have some kind of impairment, which I don't. I have no Alzheimer's. I have nothing.
Right.
Okay. I don't
can
have.
Can I also let me interrupt you really quickly. I see this the same kind of strategy with VA whistleblowers, and I've done a lot of work on the VA, and this is exactly what they do. When they play, you know, there's actually an epidemic of the VA illegally accessing medical records, but the VA absolutely does the same thing where they use these kinds of ruses to try to get mountains and mountains of medical records and then try to find anything in these medical records of these whistleblowers to use against them. So this is not something that just the bar probably got it from the VA. Like, okay, keep going, Retta.
And the next thing they want, in conjunction with these releases, which I give up every HIPAA right and every other right to privacy that I could ever have if I were to sign them, they also want me to sign a consent to go for an independent medical exam, which can be plural examinations. And the first one they want me to go to...
Wait. It's an independent but picked by the bar.
Well, the bar picks the doctors. I do not get to pick the doctors.
Is that independent?
Yes, they do.
Is that independent? That gentleman's name is James Levinson. If anyone knows anything about him, you go ahead and contact me. But right now you're scheduled to have this. And also I wanted to one other thing, just in case nobody knows, HIPAA is Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act. It's one of the biggest laws related to medicine. It's an expansive law, but when she says my HIPAA rights, among the many things that are in this law, is a whole bunch of things that you are and aren't allowed to do with medical records. And they're basically no one but someone who is treating you has the right to see your medical records unless you give that person permission.
Right. So the bar can't get them unless I waive my rights to HIPAA protections, the privacy of my medical records. But one thing about James Levinson, he's a doctor at VCU Medical Center. He's at least been doing these exams for the bar since 2009 and maybe earlier than that, but I've researched him back to 2009. He's always the bar's expert. He's always the bar's expert, not the respondent's expert.
Right,
okay,
isn't that
so
interesting?
He's a plant. I have a psychiatrist.
Right.
I'm so lucky. I have a psychiatrist because my mother had mental illness all of her life, so I had to take care of her. I have a psychiatrist who's known me for 30 years or more, 35 years, and I've had to, because I had to work with him to manage my mother, and it was very difficult. And so he's known me 35 years. And, I mean, daily I see him. He actually lives next door to me, but that's a coincidence. That was not planned. But I've known him professionally for 35 years, and he came in and wrote a long report that we gave to the bar, and then he updated it a month later and said she's never been impaired, she's not impaired, and she's not likely to ever be impaired. And the bar
right.
is ignored it.
Right. As your investigator said, the only people impaired are the ones bringing this action. I think we got about 20 minutes left. Why don't you give like a brief background of the witnesses that you were able to get to testify on your behalf and some of the things that each of them said?
That's interesting. Three lawyers showed up. The others
right.
were petrified to come. Every lawyer I talked to said, Retta, we want to come for you. We are totally supportive, but we do not want the bar to retaliate against us. One told me, I cannot watch my mother cry again. My mother's in her 80s. If I come and I represent you or I testify for you, they will come after me, and I'll have to see my mother cry again. Another set of lawyers, husband and wife, said, we want to come so badly, but they'll come after us. And you know that's true, and I do know it's true, because mm-hmm. I have firsthand experience with that particular couple. So I know that they would come after them. But three lawyers showed up, three out of a
mm-hmm.
whole state.
Mm-hmm.
They all looked like they were going to die. In the hallway. One was so bright red, I thought he was going to have a heart attack. The other guy
right.
was so nervous, he was sweating. And the third man, who's known me for 30 years or more, who's totally loyal, was so white that he looked like a piece of paper. He was so drained. He had no color in his face at all.
Let me just interrupt. I want everyone to understand that all of these people are this afraid to say, I think Retta Daniel is not impaired. They are, we've gotten to the point in society
right.
where an organization has so much power that you coming to them and saying that a lawyer that you know is not impaired is a frightening experience. Okay, I hope everyone is frightened of that.
I cannot get a Virginia lawyer except my client that I'm representing, which is really ironic. The one lawyer right now that's active that I'm representing before the board entered an appearance today to keep them from appointing me a guardian ad litem, which I don't need, but appointing me a guardian ad litem, because if I'm unrepresented, the bar can appoint a guardian ad litem without a hearing to represent me in this case. So my respondent that I'm representing entered an appearance today to represent me because the lawyer from Sands Anderson, Jeff Geiger, who's done nothing except hurt me, has filed a motion to withdraw. So I cannot go one day without an attorney, or the bar will appoint a guardian ad litem who will be another one of their shills. So my respondent client entered an appearance to represent me. I'm representing him before the same board.
So you guys are representing each other in multiple actions in front of the Virginia bar. Surreal. So why, I think we've got about 15 minutes.
Well, at least we know neither of you in much more trouble.
Yeah, my client's representing me, and I'm representing my client, and the prosecutor is the same person.
Okay, why don't we got about 15 minutes. Why don't you tell what your plan is to fight this, and you know, give like the legal details of how that's going to hopefully play out.
I asked my lawyer, who's doing a terrible job and now wants to get out, of course, to file a federal case to stop the bar, because you cannot stop them in state court. So I said, look, file a U.S. District Court case here in Richmond, where the courthouse is located, about two blocks from his office.
Before you go on, four people who don't live in the area, the Virginia State Bar proceedings happen in Richmond, the capital of Virginia, and then this federal court is also in Richmond. So the two geographically are very near each other. So if you can make it to the Virginia Bar hearing, you can make it to the federal court because they're within a few miles of each other. Keep going.
It's two blocks. Two or three blocks.
Right. Okay. I'm sorry.
Blocks.
Two or three blocks. I'm sorry. Even closer.
Yeah.
Okay. Keep going.
So they refused. They would not file a federal case to try to stop the bar, even though the bar is way out of control, way ultra vires, as we would say as lawyers, out way beyond their authority, because they have no evidence that I'm impaired. So my lawyer from this big firm says, no, we're not going to do any federal litigation for you. Now, they've got a whole federal litigation department who've represented me before in Charlottesville Federal Court. But anyway, that's beside the point. That was another case. It didn't have any merit, but their federal litigators represented me. They would not let any of their federal litigators try to stop the state bar proceedings against me. So I filed myself, pro se. I've never done a federal case in my life. I've always been a state litigator, but I have people who are loyal. They have helped me behind the scenes. They cannot come to the forefront because they're frightened to come to the forefront, but they're helping me know how to draft the pleadings to file in the federal court. So I filed on my own on Friday before the hearing. The federal court denied that TRO, which is a temporary restraining order, because I didn't know what to argue. I had to argue in federal court on federal grounds, and I didn't even know I was going to have a hearing. I thought I was going to file the papers, and the judge would rule on the papers, and often that's true. But this judge wanted to have a hearing, so I had to stay for a hearing. So I did my best, but it wasn't good enough, and I knew that, but I didn't win. So then on Monday, before the hearing started, I went and filed another motion for a temporary injunction. Well, the judge then wouldn't hear it. Even though the case was about to start against me, that judge said, no, I'm not going to hear this. Different judge. I'm not going to hear this. We'll hear it Thursday afternoon, which is tomorrow at 2 o'clock. I said, but the hearing will be over. And, you know, this is an injunction. The hearing will be over. Well, too bad, so sad. Go away. We'll see you Thursday. Well, I found out since then that actually the federal court could put me back, as they say, status quo before the hearing on Monday. I'll never be status quo. They've ruined my reputation. I've lost already $50,000 in income since this week started. $50,000 I lost in income this year. Since Monday, okay? I mean, they can't put me back status quo. That can't happen. But anyway, I'm going to court tomorrow on the temporary injunction for the case for the hearing that's already been held, but I also filed a complaint for a permanent injunction. And the permanent injunction will go ahead in federal court for a little while anyway, because the bar has to file an answer. So I'm going after the bar in federal court, and it's not going to be just on the level of my impairment.
Okay, listen,
it's going to be on the level of all the corruption.
run it in layman's terms. If you win this temporary and permanent injunction, what happens in layman, not in legalese, in layman's terms for the non-lawyers? What is it that you're hoping will be accomplished?
If I win the permanent injunction, then hopefully for me, I can recover some money because I'm having to fund all this myself because my insurance company won't pay for the federal litigation. Even though it's in my defense, they won't pay for it. The lawyer I had wouldn't file it, so I'm paying all that myself. So maybe eventually I'll have some money back. But for all the other lawyers, and we have 50,000 lawyers in Virginia, about 38,000 are practicing actively. This could happen to any lawyer at any time if the bar decides they want to take them out. They could charge them with being impaired. Because if they can charge me with being impaired, they can charge anyone with being impaired. Because I am a super lawyer, and I'm not patting myself on the back. I've never asked for any of those awards that you pay for, but I'm a super lawyer. I'm the go-to person for ethical advice in Virginia, other than the state bar, and you can't rely on their ethical advice because it's not correct. But anyway, if they can go after someone like me, with my background, 41 years of no ethical violations, 41 years of no client complaints, and I've been a litigation lawyer since I started in 1977. I am an open target for complaints, walking down the street every day. If I
Wait,
can do that,
non-lawyers aren't going to understand. Why, as a litigation lawyer, are you a target for complaints?
Well, it's sort of simple. When people quit fighting with each other, they fight with their lawyers. So
okay.
When the litigation is over, you often have clients file complaints against the litigation lawyer because they're still mad and they can't fight with each other anymore. So they want to fight with their lawyer and say the lawyer did a bad job. So you're
right.
As a litigation lawyer.
So your point being that. Your point being that if you're in that type of a field and you still don't have any complaints, you obviously know what you're doing. Hey, the rest of you guys, I think we got a few minutes. Are there any questions or you guys want to add some comments?
Hey, I have a caller. I'm going to bring them in, okay, and see what they have to say. 312, you're on the air.
Welcome to the show.
Hello. Hi, Lulu and Robin. Good evening. Hi. Can you guys hear me?
Yeah.
Hi, good evening. I've got a question for Retta, and I guess also Michael as well. Have you considered, since you're already now moving into federal court, have you considered filing a racketeering lawsuit instead of just pleading for an injunction on what's going on in the state court?
That's a great question. Many people, lawyers.
Wait, Retta, before you explain that, explain what racketeering is and what that would mean, a racketeering lawsuit.
It's kind of, I think he's talking about a RICO suit, and that's where
right.
I have a number
right. RICO is Racketeer Influenced Corrupt Organizations Act. It was originally done to take on the mafia and then organized crime in general. So all sorts of gangs and other types of organized crime fall into that. Racketeering is where you basically create the situation where an illegal act is necessary. So, you know, like mobsters come into your store and say, if you don't want your windows broken, you're going to pay me $50 a week. That's a racket. And, you know, essentially what this gentleman is saying is the Virginia bar is, in a sense, creating the same a racket in a general sense, in the same way that a mobster walks into a store. Okay, so keep going.
Yeah, but what the bar is saying to me in answer to that question is that if I don't sign these releases for my medical records and I don't sign the consents to have independent medical exams by their doctors of their choice, they're going to suspend my license without a hearing.
Right, and that is the racket. And by the way, the most famous racketeer, at least in America, is Al Capone. So what you're talking about is the same type of a crime that his gambling dens and liquor distribution and brothels were. This is the same type of thing.
That's the very reason I've lost $50,000 in income this week. because I had to give up two expert witness cases that would bring in about $50,000 of income to me in 2018 because they have threatened to suspend my license, which they will do, and it's ruined my reputation. Now I can be impeached as an expert witness because someone can say, well, the bar charged you with being impaired. Well, yeah, they did charge me with that. It wasn't legitimate, but they've ruined my professional reputation as an expert witness, which is a major part of my law practice now. That and financial fraud.
What can be done about that? I mean, what can happen? I mean, you got to stop this.
Well, it's, I don't remember who the politician is, but where do I go to get my reputation back? Yeah, but getting your reputation back, that ship has sailed. She's filing this injunction. This gentleman from Chicago had an idea that you could file a racketeering suit or just a RICO suit. A lot of this stuff really does, if you understand what RICO means, and certainly the spirit and the letter of the law, a lot of this stuff falls under RICO. Most of these cases are situations where people create artificially the need for them to step in, and that is the very definition of a racket. You're not supposed to be there. You're creating the scenario where you're there. You know, and that example that I had of the mobster showing up into your store and saying, if you don't want your windows broken, you're going to pay me, is, you know, probably the simplest form of a racket, but they can get more complicated. And what the bar is doing in this case is the very definition of a racket. And I think most of the guardianship abuse stories you hear and the family court abuse stories you hear, they also fall into that racketeering sphere.
Well, the same thing happened to Mary Jones. That Ferguson told Mary Jones in front of Bill Gardner, if they didn't back off, he was going to institute a guardianship case against her father, and she would never see him again. The bar is saying to me, if you don't sign these releases, we're going to take your license, and you'll never practice law again. This is what you're saying.
On the Mary Jones case, were any of the assets outside of the state of Virginia? I mean, was there any interstate, assets or transactions involved?
No.
Maybe with investment companies like Raymond James, who has their main offices in Florida. And Edward Jones is another investment company. Those cross state lines. So yes,
right.
The answer is
yes. I think what the question implied, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but if you can prove that makes it a federal, literally a federal case, which would fall under the FBI. And so presumably what the questioner is hoping is it possible for you to get it away from the Virginia authorities and into a federal authority who you hope is going to be less corrupt? I don't know if I was reading that.
We've already done it. We've already done it. And they didn't. They haven't done anything.
You've already gone to the FBI, and the FBI won't do anything. Listen, in my experience, unless the FBI thinks you're important, then it doesn't matter if you're a victim of a crime, because they just don't care. They do not care.
FBI. We went to the IRS because of fraudulent tax returns and money stolen out of an IRS refund that's owed to the federal government. And a tax return filed with a Michigan address for Judge Jones when he never lived anywhere except in Virginia, and they won't touch it. We've been to the U.S. attorneys. We've been to the local police. We've been to the postal authorities. Nobody will touch it.
So here's where I was kind of going with this, is I understand – you know, as I was listening to some of the facts of that other case, you know, you were attacking it from one set of laws. If you were looking at it from racketeering and under the RICO statutes, you may have another legitimate cause of action, being that interstate commerce was involved by the definition
You're
of
correct.
What interstate commerce is. And so
That's
now you
correct.
Can bring a whole new case under RICO, okay, and what was going on in the Mary Jones situation, as well as what has since happened to you with the Virginia State Bar Association. And to
and
your point earlier that you've got other attorneys out there who are potential victims, this creates a whole pattern, you know, that I think is worth maybe looking into. I don't, you know, you understand the facts of your case better than anybody. I'm just asking the question, if you can, you know, if you can look at it in the light or in the context of a RICO suit, do you have a cause of action now in federal court?
Okay, we've got two RICO possibilities. One is state, one is federal. State's hopeless. So federal is viable. You can either do civil or criminal RICO. Civil takes a lot of money, and she doesn't have it to spend on a civil RICO. If we could get the public corruption section or division of the FBI to take any interest in Mary Jones's case, because it is completely inextricably bound to the Virginia State Bar, because they've done nothing to prevent the harms to her, nothing. Okay. So if we can get the public corruption division of the FBI to take a look at it, there could be criminal RICO. But we've got
right.
to get them to look at it first.
Right.
Well,
as a friend of mine would say, if it was a fifth, we'd all be drunk. But I think we're running out of time now.
Well, no, we're gonna carry it over just a little bit. We can still do that.
Okay.
So,
all right.
Okay.
How many more minutes, you guys? Gonna go. How many
yeah,
more
we
minutes?
Could,
is
yeah,
there another question? Another question?
Yeah, go ahead,
yeah,
Gil. Is there another question?
I'd like to continue this conversation and maybe offline, because there's certainly a lot of aspects to this. I will say that, you know, I as an individual have had some experience. In fact, I'm going through some of this stuff right now. And I would be very happy to speak with both of you, you know, Retta and Michael, a little bit further. I know, Michael, you've done a lot of work in investigating the type of corruption in these courts. And you know, just hands up to you, you know, for what you did with your publication on, you know, the McNee case, you know, in your book. I'm familiar with that. And I've seen a lot of that firsthand. If it's possible, I'd be very happy to you know, speak with you guys offline and tell you a little bit more in terms of, from my perspective, you know, what's going on here.
I think
Retta,
that would be great.
And we can put you in touch with him if you don't mind us giving him your number, or if you would like us to give you his number, we can arrange for you to talk.
Right.
You
that,
can
that would
both.
Be terrific. That would be
do
terrific.
Both.
I'd like to do that. Yeah, I'd like to do that offline.
I can send you his information too.
Yeah, please.
I'm sorry,
go ahead.
I understand your question.
Right, we will.
Yeah,
arrange.
Go ahead and give my information.
Well, this week has been amazing. I can't even tell you, Retta. I can't even tell you how, you know, you coming on and telling this story is amazing. And Michael, you did an amazing story bringing it out. You did an amazing job bringing the story out. And I didn't know it was this deep and this intertwined with corruption. I mean, I'm just sad.
Well, I think that what you have done is you have built the edifice of truth around corruption to where it's pretty obvious encroachment on the rights of the citizens of Virginia, the way that these courts are operating.
Mm-hmm.
And it's laudable to be in your position, because I know what kind of guts it takes, what kinds of determination it takes, what kinds of persistence it takes.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, and it's
to me, you are superheroes because it takes that kind of commitment
right.
that is very extraordinary and very unusual
uh-huh.
to advance something to the level where you have it at this point. Against these odds, they're incredible odds. I know, you know, we've seen this. Your story, unfortunately, is not unique in that we know others who have been through through similar odysseys and wound up, you know, being disbarred and wound up, aspects of their life being ruined. So I appreciate your willingness to bring this forward and your determination to bring it forward and your dedication mm-hmm. to justice and to that cause.
Right. And if anything really positive, you know, comes on or whatever the outcome is, we'd like to bring you back on the show and talk to you a little bit more about that. Okay.
Thank you. Because I've waited 36 years to do this. I've been determined for 36 years that this bar was not going to get away with its corruption. And I challenged them individually on every case for 36 years. And then finally, after 36 years, I could take them head on, publicly take them head on. And that has been my vow to myself since 1982.
Well, we appreciate what you're doing, and we're with you, and we'll do all that we can. In other words, bring you to the attention of our listeners. We'll help you network with the gentleman who called in, and we sure appreciate you coming on our show. We thank you,
and Michael. And Michael, thank you so much for bringing a great journalist. We appreciate you very much.
Sure do.
Greta, thank you.
Well, I appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. You're very welcome. Thank you to all our listeners. Thank you for joining us for another issue of Face Us with Robin and Lulu and Marcy. And we will see you next week, same time, same channel.
Right, exactly. Thank you, everybody. Have a good night. We're going to play a little music from Danny Tate. Thank you. Good night, all the listeners.
All right, thanks. Good night.
Good night. Good night, everybody. Thank you.